Good morning. It's time to read the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, December 22nd. My name's Mike Dam. I'll be with you for the next hour. I am pleased to be with you. This broadcast is made possible through a partnership between Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. Here are today's headlines on the front page of the Globe Gazette. No sanctioning yet, but girls' wrestling continues to grow. A mailbox in Northwood has a long holiday history. The front page picture is of Mason City with booms on it, four of them. It's the talk of the town when it happens. What is the source of the booms we hear from time to time? And then the headline is, what's up with all these booms, Mason City? Too many requests to handle. Iowa farmers seek flood easements in record numbers. And Sirigorta County Board, 30-plus appointment terms expire on December 31. Today's weather. Patchy freezing fog during the morning and partly to mostly sunny and mild today. Expect 4 to 8 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity of 75% and poor drying conditions. Mainly clear tonight, areas of freezing fog late, average relative humidity 80%, and areas of freezing fog for tomorrow morning. Monday, freezing fog in the morning, 42 for a high, 27 for a low. And Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, a little cloudy, a little fog, but highs in the 30s, high 30s to low 40s, and the lows in the 30s. So with our first story, what's up with all these booms, Mason City? A frost explosion? A meteor sonic boom? Blown transformers, trains, tannerite, fireworks, buildups in the sewer line, or aliens? Yes, aliens. All these have been offered up as possible culprits for a semi-regular, unexplained boom that's been heard by residents of Mason City for the past few years. Some insist they only hear it in the southeast part of town, while others insist it's farther north. Even the intensity of the boom isn't wholly agreed upon. Some of that would be explained by location. The further away you are from something, the less intense it's going to sound, after all. But there's a lot of metaphorical distance between someone messing around with something as explosive as tannerite and frostquakes or cryosisms, which can happen when ice in the ground expands too rapidly. The subheading, uncertainty about the sources. Mason City Police Chief Jeff Brinkley said there isn't even a consensus on the cause from the calls the department gets and what officers hear for themselves. In a couple of cases, we have found they have had a business or industrial cause. In one case, we found one person who had made homemade firework, and many of the rest we are unsure about, Brinkley relayed. He added that the booms do appear to be sporadic. There isn't a pattern that we have been able to identify, which is backed up by plotting locations and mentioned in the North Iowa Rant and Rave comments thread on Facebook. Using that as a resource, booms have been heard at or near 9th Street Southeast, North Madison, East Park, 12th Street Southeast, South Virginia Avenue, North Kentucky Avenue, Southside McDonald's, and the entire east side of town. And I live by East Park, and I have heard them. We would like to have residents call when they have information that may help us identify the source of the noise or the area where it originated, Brinkley said. Nighttime is the wrong time. I hear them mostly in the evening, but they have happened in the middle of the day, which makes you sit up straight in bed. Or middle of the night, which makes you sit up straight in bed, said Mason City resident Lori Capers. Capers said she herself can't hasn't contacted the local officials about the matter, but has heard rumblings about a homemade cannon being to blame. Though at the same turn she mentions the possibility, Casper somewhat dismisses it. If I was this person's neighbor, I would have turned them in a long time ago, she said. Based on her own timeline, Casper thinks it's going on since last winter, which would lead credence to the ice boom theory, but she swears she's heard it. Oh, sorry. Fumbling fingers. Similar noises in the summer. In the summertime as well. As frigid as Iowa can get, conditions for cryosisms aren't quite right in mid-August. Nicole Kirsten, who lives on the northeast side of 12th Street, has also heard it, in parentheses, for about a year, and usually at night, like capers. One time it sounded like it was in my backyard and scared the living crap out of me. Woke up on a dead sleep, Kirsten remembered. She cycled through the area about what's caused such a headache. At first, she just dismissed it as train cars hooking up. Then she, too, considered a cannon possibility after the last instance of firework. I honestly have no idea what it is. It's just totally weird. I'm getting so used to the boom that if it ever stops, I'd be like, where's the boom? She joked. Something bigger is the subheading. In July of this year, AccuWeather ran a story entitled Mysterious Skyquakes Continue Across the World with Few Answers to Their Origins. The story's author, Michael Kuhn, cited a figure that more than 64 different instances involving loud, unexplained booms worldwide were reported in 2017, according to the New York Post report. Later in the piece, he reckoned that possible explanations for the boom include lightning from distant thunderstorms, large meteors entering the atmosphere, earthquakes, mining operations such as blasting and supersonic aircraft, and there was a case in San Diego that was attributed to jets. But the closest large military base to Mason City is Camp Dodge in Johnston, so that wouldn't explain the larger, closer booms. So maybe aliens? The question mark is on the subheading. The website Mysterious Universe looked into the matter in February and said there was a deafening silence on the part of law enforcement bodies. And while the article stopped short of X-Files type speculation, the author does suggest that someone out there knows something the public doesn't. To its credit, the article does also make mention of the Bader-Meinhof phenomenon, or recent illusion. Think of it like buying a car and then starting to notice that make and model of the car on the road a lot more because now you have a reason to look for it. That's the Bader-Meinhof phenomenon. The threshold for confirmation bias is low, too, so it doesn't take much for the effect to take hold. And that may well be it then. It's to a point where residents have almost trained themselves to listen for the boom. If it's aliens, though, we'll at least know when they're here. And I have heard the boom. It sounds very much like the cannon going off when they're doing the Renaissance in the park. And I live like 3 blocks from the park, so interesting. I was hoping they were going to answer the question. Cerro Gordo County Board, 30-plus appointment terms expire December 31. One crucial aspect in the functioning of county government across the state of Iowa is the staffing of volunteer boards and commissions that consider issues such as landfill use, workforce development, and zoning. There's no different in Cerro Gordo County. Oh, that's no different in Cerro Gordo County, where terms tend to last anywhere from 1 year to 6 years. Since they're annual appointments, all of the one-year term positions are set to expire on December 31. But those aren't the only ones. In total, 33 positions, as listed on the Sarasota County Volunteer Boards and Commissions page, will have their terms expire on December 31. Applications for the county's 44 boards and commissions can be filed at any time with the Sarasota County Board of Supervisors, along with a separate form for the board or commission someone is considering serving on. Per the county's site, applications will be retained for 18 months even if someone isn't appointed, and then destroyed if not redacted. State law requires the supervisors strive to balance appointive boards, commissions, committees, and council according to gender. Certain board members can be impacted by location of residence, veteran status, occupation, or other lawful criteria. It should be open to anyone that's interested, County Board member Chris Watt said, while also mentioning that people may apply right up until the deadline of the 31st. Watt said it's a positive for as many people to apply as possible because it can lead to some new perspectives. There might be someone out there with good ideas for the County Board of Conservation. Further descriptions about the positions can be found on Sarasota County website under the aforementioned Volunteer Board and Commissions tab. Of the positions, there are a few listed here. Cherokee Advisory Board, the Civil Service Commission, Clear Project Advisory Board, Board of Health, County Conservation Board, County Social Services Governing Board, County Zoning Commission, Decategorization Governance Board, Department of Correctional Services, Second Judicial District Board, Emergency Management Commission, Empowerment Area Board of Directors for Sarasota, Hancock, and Worth Counties, Landfill of North Iowa Board of Directors, NIACOG Regional Planning Board of Directors, NIACOG North Central Region Emergency Response Commission, NIACOG Revolving Loan Fund Committee, NIACOG Transportation Policy Board, North Iowa Juvenile Detention Services Commission, North Iowa Vocational Center Board, and Workforce Development Board. Picture in the paper, page 2. Jesusia Christian, Hancock County Sheriff Scott Dodd is pictured. Hancock County Sheriff proposes new jail administrator. First came additional deputies, then more inmates, then an overload of paperwork. Late last month, Hancock County Sheriff Scott Dodd went before the Hancock County Board of Supervisors looking for a jail administrator to handle the extra workload. Supervisors approved moving forward with further consideration of budgeting for a new jail administrator, agreeing with Dodd that overseeing an average of 9 inmates required a new position in his department. Back in January of 2017, Dodd said, "Myself and the board worked with the county attorney's office. Since Forest City was going to build a new jail, we had decided that we would hopefully plan and work towards moving our inmates there. But then both jail positions opened up after the existing employees left. The Forest City jail was not done at that point," said Dodd, "so inmates were moved to Sarasota County. Once the Winnebago County jail was done, they moved inmates to Winnebago County." Dodd said he had looked at the previous 7 years from 2017 and found the department was averaging 7 inmates a day back then. Since then, it has increased to 10. "Increases are due to several factors," said Dodd. "We added another deputy to our staff about 3 years ago. The Garner Police Department has added another officer, and the Britt Police Department has increased to 5 officers. When we increase staff, arrests go up. I don't expect numbers to go down." Dodd commented that once the jail staff had left, those left in the police department took over all the paperwork, which was an increase with more inmates. The new jail administrator position, who would start in July of 2020, would handle all of that. Dodd said he'd also like to hire and train the person while he is still with the department. A new sheriff will be elected in 2020. Dodd said he'd also like to hire and train the... Dodd said his current budget is about $175,000, which covers holding inmates and providing care and food, as well as training for officers to stay jail certified. A new jail administrator would require $250,000 or less for salary and benefits. And that a used vehicle would serve for transportation purposes. For us, using another jail is working very well. Winnebago has growing pains with their new jail, as would anybody, Dodd said. So we are going to continue to work with that person to solve small issues that we have. That is one reason we would like a jail administrator. Dodd said the jail administrator could be cross-trained to help with the dispatch center. This cross-training trained person would also be available to help with civil matters, Dodd said, such as garnishments and sex offenders, which is needed as there are 20 sex offenders in the county and 50 that come to work in the county that the department has to check on. The Hancock County Board of Supervisors agreed to place the request on the agenda for their meeting to further discuss the consideration of jail administrator position. Cheer Fund donations through Tuesday, December 17. Did you notice we've passed the tipping point with under $60,000 left to raise, but we're running out of time. Please give if you can. There are many in our area who need our help. Today's total, $6,792. To date total, $66,549. And to reach the goal, $58,450.60 is still needed. The Christmas Cheer Fund was established by the Globe Gazette publisher Lee Lomas in 1927, so every child could have a present on Christmas morning. In the years since, it has come to mean a little help at Christmas time to people of all ages. Donations may be dropped off or mailed to the Globe Gazette office, 300 North Washington, Mason City, 50402. We guarantee that your gift, no matter the size, will help someone in North Iowa have a better, brighter Christmas, just like every Christmas since the Cheer Fund founded in 1929. Northwood Mailbox has a direct line to Santa. For more than 50 years, eager children have flocked to the large red mailbox off Central Avenue in Northwood to mail letters such each Christmas season to Santa Claus. The box itself has seen only a few changes over the years. When it used to have an abbreviated form of Merry Christmas on the front, the letters are now spelled out in its entirety. The box also used to have a large flag. Letters from the children are placed into the slot in the front. Everybody loves it, George Zentz said. It gets a lot of use. The mailbox, built in 1968 at the suggestion of Geary George, who was part of the J.C. Club at the time, sits in the same spot every year. George had helped construct a similar mailbox with the J.C.'s Club when his family lived in Waverly, Iowa. When the family moved to Northwood, he brought up the idea with the J.C.'s here, too. His daughter, Teresa George Wins, who now serves on the Northwood City Council and is the president of the Northwood Area Chamber of Commerce, said she was one of the first four children to place a letter in the mailbox when it was set up for the first year. She was 4 years old at the time. She has a digital copy of the photograph featuring her and her sister and her father along with two other children and the first other adults from the first year the mailbox was in place. Over the years, the area around the mailbox has developed to include a Santa village, with a recent small house, and more recently a large postcard created by George Wentz's mother, Gloria George, that people can step behind and put their faces into for photos. George Wentz said her mother has been a big part of the tradition and also decorates the mailbox and the village. She said she regularly sees children walk across the street to the mailbox, drop their letters off, and then spend time in the Santa village for a while. The school kids come in groups, she said. All the children who place a letter in the mailbox should expect to receive a letter back as long as they include an address, she said. Children who want to see Santa before Christmas can do so from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Christmas Eve. Northwood's large red mailbox to Santa Claus has been a children's holiday must-stop for over 50 years. Located off Central Avenue, the mailbox is a popular local tradition. Too many requests to handle. Iowa farmers seek flood easements in record numbers. Historically, wet years and flooding throughout the state have pushed hundreds of Iowa farmers to voluntarily offer to take tens of thousands of acres out of crop production. When Iowa earlier this year received approval for a federal program that compensated farmers who opt to take flood-damaged land out of production, officials expected maybe a few dozen applications. They received 400 applications covering more than 41,000 acres. The applications poured in from across the state, not just near the Missouri and Mississippi rivers on the state's eastern and western borders. We kind of anticipated that there would be at least some level of interest outside of the Missouri River floodplains, but we had no concept of how much, said John Hubert, Iowa's assistant state conservationist in the federal agricultural program. The state had just had the wettest two-year stretch on record from December 2017 through November 2019, according to data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That has taken a toll on Iowa farmland. The federal government in August approved $36 million for agricultural land damage by flooding. Under the program, farmers agree to sell the U.S. government a portion of their land, which is taken out of crop production and returned to its natural floodplain condition. In order to be eligible for the program, farmland must experience flooding in at least twice in the past 10 years and received significant damage. Federal officials say they expected 30 to 40 applications, not the 393 received. Typically, we don't have this kind of sign-up for our emergency programs, particularly for floodplain easements, said Kurt Simon, the state conservationist in the Federal Agricultural Department. These historic precipitation levels and severe floods have forced Iowa farmers to consider taking land out of production, said Chad Hart, associate professor of economics who studies crop markets in the Iowa State University. The year 2019 was a wet year. 2018 was a wet year. I think that created a greater incentive for farmers to really look at this program and possibly apply for it. Officials said they also were surprised by the geographical breadth of the applications. Many, as expected, came from farmers along the Missouri River, which flooded earlier this year after levees and temporary flood walls breached. But many applications also came from other areas, including high concentration of application along the Cedar River in Muscatine County and the Iowa River in Iowa County in southeast Iowa, along the Turkey River in Clayton, Iowa in northeast, and multiple forks of the Des Moines River in Palo Alto and Kossuth counties in northwest Iowa. It ended up being the full state, Hubert said. So we weren't looking strictly at the Missouri River Valley. It was across the state, so it was damages that pretty much have been ongoing for quite a few years, and we just haven't had an opportunity for people to sign up. So now's their opportunity. Official and experts said the high volume of applications is not necessarily a cause for concern. The roughly 41,000 acres offered to be taken out of production represents just a sliver, just 0.1% of the 23 million acres of crops in Iowa. I think it's pretty common knowledge that we've been having flooding concerns along our major rivers quite a bit in the last few years. So from that perspective, it's not surprising to me, Simon said. We just didn't expect it because there are permanent easements. These are permanent easements. So these farms will be taken out of agricultural production and allowed to go back to their natural state. The higher-than-expected participation suggests farmers along Iowa waterways are feeling the effects of record precipitation and flooding and have made the financial decision that it is easier to sell the impacted land, Hart said. I think it does reflect not only the weather conditions but also the financial condition on farms these days. The farm economy has struggled for the past 5 years or so, and so in this case, this gives some farmers some opportunities to, if you will, at least ease out or at least create some stable forms of revenue as they look to manage their farms. With the abundance of applications, federal officials are faced with a task of determining which to approve given the financial constraints of the program. The $36 million will only go so far. They hope more funding will be made available, but nothing has been promised, officials said. The federal ag officials said this agency employs a system that ranks applications by ground that has been most significantly damaged and that is no longer profitable. Hubert said, for example, he spoke with a Missouri River Valley farmer who has had one successful crop in the last 10 years. There isn't ground that they're looking to do something different with because crop production is really not working for them. A landfill of North Iowa names new education coordinator. Krista Latch has joined the landfill of North Iowa as the education coordinator. According to release from the landfill of North Iowa, Latch will be active in giving tours, leading field trips, and educating North Iowans on the importance of waste reduction and recycling. A native of North Iowa, Latch grew up near Burt, Iowa, and graduated from Central of Fenton High School. Latch received her AA degree from NIAC and completed her BS degree at Iowa State University. Latch's education and love for the outdoors led to work experiences as a naturalist intern at Lime Creek Nature Center and the water patrol officer for the DNR. Latch lives with her husband Steve and children Piper and Steele near Manly. She enjoys spending time outdoors teaching her children about nature and bow hunting in the fall. Latch can be reached at education@landfillnorthiowa.org. Mason City Clinic awards grants to North Iowa organizations. The Mason City Clinic Charitable Giving Committee recently awarded grants to several organizations in the North Iowa area. According to the release, the Charitable Giving Committee, which was established in 1990, supports funding for projects that enhance health, safety, and educational programs in North Iowa communities. We feel it is important to give an organization to give back to the communities we serve. And this committee structure provides us an organized approach for our corporate giving, said committee president Mark Molsky. Committee members are Dr. Timothy Detmer, Harsha Jayawardena, Mark Lassus, Timothy Mulholland, Mark Mulkey, and Renee Racinos. 2019 Charitable Grant Awards, Clear Lake School District, Exceptional Opportunities, Inc., Francis Lauer, North Iowa Farmers Market, One Vision, and Roosevelt Elementary School. Education, Charles McNider, Mason City Foundation, Mason City High School Tennis Boosters, Mason City Public Library, NIAC, Boy Scouts, and United Way. Safety, City of Mason City Fire Department, Mason City Police Department, and the Mason City Youth Baseball Association. Building and Reconstruction, Living Free Ministry, River City Sculptures on Parade. Mason City Clinic is a group of physician specialists serving over 14 counties in the North Iowa area. Organizations may access an application on their website at www.mcclinic.com. Mason City Ford Chrysler has donates to breast cancer fundraiser. Mason City Ford Chrysler has donated $1,400 from their October Breast Cancer Awareness Fundraiser to the Mercy Cancer Center. Clear Lake Family Physician receives Achievement Award. Clear Lake Family Physician Willis Dankel, MD, was awarded the 2019 Lifetime Achievement Award recently by the Iowa Academy of Family Physicians. We'll go to remembrances. Sharon Barbara Syme Matson, Alvreda M. Miller Payton, Dolores I. Lobb or Lobby from Waverly, Michelle Marie Mann. And death notices, Rita R. Brecka Kern, 89 Garner. Father R. Joseph Murowski, 71 Mason City. Iris Nelson, 97 of Belmont. Bernice M. Hartwig, 94 of Osage. Mary M. Paulus, 94 of Mason City, and Shirley V. Tatum, 96 of Fort Dodge, formerly of Mason City. Sharon Barbara Syme Matson passed away with family by her side on December 6th at Oz Hagen Senior Services in Decorah, Iowa. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, December 28, at First Lutheran Church in Decorah, with Reverend Chad Hubner officiating. Visitation will begin at 10 a.m. Saturday, 1 hour before the service at the First Lutheran Church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be given to the Oz Haugen Senior Services, Decorah, Iowa, or First Lutheran Church in Decorah. Pellstuhl Funeral Home in Decorah is serving the family. Alveda M. Miller Payton was born December 19, 1928, to Lawrence and Emma Nicolette Miller of rural Thornton, Iowa. She passed away at Sheffield Care Center, Sheffield, Iowa, on her 91st birthday. Visitation will be Saturday, December 21, from 5 to 7 p.m. I guess it was held at Reitz Funeral Home, Thornton, and continue an hour before the service at the First United Methodist Church in Thornton. Celebration of Life will be held 2 o'clock today, Sunday, December 22nd, at the First United Methodist Church in Thornton. Interment will be at Pleasant View Cemetery in Thornton. Alveda graduated from Thornton High School and Ellsworth College, where she received her teaching certificate. She taught in the Thornton school system prior to marrying Donald G. Payton on June 5, 1949. They farmed northeast of Thornton and were blessed with the arrival of 3 children. A focal point of her life was nurturing her family and friends. She was first on the scene with food and a comforting word. A coffee pot was always on, a welcome person, and a handmade baked goods available. Farm living was the life for her. Alveda was a lifetime faithful member, volunteer, and supporter of the First United Methodist Church. In 1981, they relocated to Humboldt, where they made new friends. Alveda and Don returned to Thornton in 1989, where Alveda took up golfing, resuming her church activities and gophering for the farm operation. Dolores, I, Lube, Lob, Lobby, I'm not sure which, L-A-U-B-E, 90 of Waverly, died Thursday, December 19 at the Waverly Healthcare Center in Waverly. Dolores Eileen Peterson was born July 14, 1929 on the family farm in Strand, Adams County, Iowa, to Elmer and Myrtle Larson Peterson. She was baptized January 8, 1930 at the Strand Lutheran Church by Pastor E.O. Ulring. At the age of 9, her family moved to Cerro Gordo County, where she continued to attend rural schools, graduating from Rockwell High School in 1946. Dolores was confirmed on January 10, 1943 at St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Rockwell, Iowa by Pastor Fred Landeck. On June 5, 1949, she married John W. Luby of Waverly at St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Rockwell, with Reverend O. Einen presiding. They made their home in Waverly. Dolores graduated from Wartburg College with at first a two-year degree and later a four-year elementary teacher's degree in 1965. In 1972, she received a master's degree in developmental reading from the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Her teaching career also began in the rural school in Cerro Gordo County. She also taught in public schools in Osage and Nashua. Dolores was a teacher at St. Paul Lutheran Church School for 33 years. During those years, cooperatively with Wartburg College, she supervised over 30 student teachers. She retired in 1991, but continued tutoring with co-workers, created and produced a weekly workshop bulletin for children. In 1991, she helped initiate an after-school program at St. Paul's, where she was a member and belonged to the Bowman Circle. In 1953 and 1965, she received commissions as an educator in the American Lutheran Church. In 1977, she was commissioned by the Associate in Ministry in the Evangelical Church in America. She was a member of Wartburg Women's Club, Delta Kappa Gamma, Bremer County Genealogy and Historical Societies, Friends of the Waverly Library, and Sons of Norway, where she served various offices and committees. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, December 30, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Waverly, with Pastor Arthur Berggren officiating. Burial will follow in the church cemetery. Visitation will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. on Sunday, December 29, at Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly, and for an hour prior to the service at the church on Monday. Memorials may be sent and directed to St. Paul's Lutheran School. Michelle, and I'm saying Michelle, it's M-I-C-H-A-L, Michael, Michelle, Marie Mann, passed away on Tuesday, December 3rd, 2019. Surrounded by her loving family in Northridge Hospital in Los Angeles, California. Michelle and her twin sister, Morgan, were born May 17, 1983 in Mason City, Iowa, and welcomed as a true blessing into the family of Paul and Tommy Mann. She graduated with honors from Lincoln High School in Wisconsin Rapids in 2002 and the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, majoring in theater and costume design. Her career highlights include an internship with the Santa Fe Opera, a position as a wardrobe tech in Las Vegas for the Circus de Sol show and working in closed caption in L.A. promoting accessibility in movies and television. Michelle will always be known for her kind and compassionate spirit. She was extremely creative with passion for art, music, and theater. She was happy on stage or behind the scenes. Her whole life, it was rare to find her without a notebook in hand sketching. The twin bond she shared with her sister was very deep. Morgan was her best friend and soulmate. Michelle will be greatly missed. Celebration of Life will take place on Friday, December 27 at 1:30 p.m. at Trinity Lutheran in Mason City. Memorials may be sent to Michelle's favorite high school highlight, the Wisconsin Rapids Public School District, payee, care of Michael Mann Performing Arts Center, and that is 510 Peach Street, Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin, 54494. Some death notices. Bernice M. Hartwig, 94, of La Crosse, Wisconsin, formerly of Osage, died Wednesday, December 18, at Bethany Riverside Transitional Care in La Crosse. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, December 27, at Trinity Lutheran Church in Osage, with Reverend Bruce Kaltwasser officiating. Burial in Osage Cemetery. Visitation is 10 to 11 Friday at the church. Champion Boucher Funeral Home is helping with arrangements. Mary M. Paulus, 94, of Mason City, died Wednesday, December 18, at Heritage Care and Rehabilitation Center in Mason City. Services are 11 a.m. Friday, December 27, at Epiphany Parish, Holy Family Catholic Church, Mason City, with the Reverend Neil Monternach as celebrant. Visitation is 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday at Hogan Bremmer Moore Colonial Chapel, with a scriptural wake service to follow. Memorials to Mercy One North Iowa Hospice or Epiphany Parish. Rita R. Brecka Kern, 89, of Garner, died Friday, December 20, at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice in Mason City. Funeral services are 10:30 a.m. Saturday, December 28, at St. Boniface Catholic Church in Garner, with Reverend Jim Dubert officiating. Burial in St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Duncan. Visitation will be 4 to 6 p.m. Friday at the Cataldo Funeral Home in Garner, with a scriptural wake service at 3:30 p.m., followed by a Rosary Society rosary. Visitation will resume 1 hour prior to services at the church. Memorials to St. Boniface Catholic Church or Mercy One of North Iowa Hospice. Father R. Joseph Murowski, 71, Mason City, priest at Holy Transfiguration Greek Orthodox Church, died Friday, December 20. Visitation is 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, December 23rd, at Major Erickson Funeral Home in Mason City. Other arrangements are pending at this time. Major Erickson Funeral Home is helping with arrangements. Iris M. Nelson, 97, of Belmont, died Thursday, December 19, at the Rehabilitation Center of Belmont. Funeral services will be 1 p.m. Monday, December 23rd at Ewing Funeral Home in Belmont, with Marge Osier officiating. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery in Rowan. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to services at the funeral home. And Shirley V. Tatum, 96, of Fort Dodge and formerly of Mason City, died Friday, December 20, at Fort Dodge Health and Rehabilitation Center. Services are 2 p.m. Friday, December 27, at Hoger Bremmer Moore Colonial Chapel in Mason City, with student pastor Sue Sura officiating. Burial in Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the funeral service at the chapel. In celebrations, Joanne White of Grafton celebrated her birthday, 90th birthday, Thursday, December 12. Please help her celebrate her special day by sending greetings to her 205 South Higley Road, Space 161, Mesa, Arizona. We got rhythm, Mason City. This is John Skipper. In the subheading, it is possible for cities and governments to be in good rhyme. Clear Lake seems to be that way all the time, with government functioning effectively and being in step with the community, and the community being in step with it. Have you ever been at a concert or some other musical program in which the audience began rhythmic clapping in sync with the music? And in an effort to join in, have you ever found yourself about a half a clap off, where you're not quite with the rest of them? You have to hesitate and try to get the rhythm of the thing. Otherwise, as they clap, you clap, they clap, you clap, until you just give up and fold your hands and listen. Being out of rhythm can apply to a lot of things related to music. What if the trumpet player or the drummer is not in step with the rest of the band? I'm not a musician, but I think the rhythm principle applies to many other areas of life. We've all had days when we have felt like we were a half a clap behind the rest of the world, haven't we? This whole concept came up recently in conversation I had with a friend who, in his day, was a pretty good athlete. In high school, more than a few years ago, he was a pitcher on a baseball team. He said if the opposing team was going to get him, they'd better do it early in the game before he got into his rhythm. The same is true in professional baseball today. I don't have quite the same frame of reference from my younger days as pitcher. Let's put it this way. If the strike zone was high and outside, I'd be in the Hall of Fame. This rhythm thing is true in other sports as well. Football and basketball coaches often call timeouts for no other reason than to break the rhythm of the other team. Is it possible for cities and governments to be in a good rhythm? Clear Lake seems to be that way all the time, with government functioning effectively and being in step with the community and the community being in step with it. For years, it has seemed like Mason City was a half a clap off. There was either needless bickering among the student or city council members, or the public whining or engaging in legitimate or not so legitimate protests about one thing or another. And while there was progress, it wasn't fine-tuned. As we look back on this year and look forward to the next, there is a sense that Mason City is now working in rhythm and enjoying the support of the community. The opening of the Ice Arena Multipurpose Center is one example. Start of construction of the apartment complex downtown is another. Plans for the new hotel are moving along, finally. Businesses are starting up. Others are expanding. The mayor, city administrator, and council all seem to be in concert with one another. It doesn't mean they always agree on every single thing, but there's a palpable rhythm to what is going on in the community, and the community feels it. City government sets the tone for that. There's a song made famous a century ago in which one of the lines is, "I got rhythm. Who could ask for anything more?" As the joy of Christmas and hopes for the new year approach, let us all work toward not being half a clap behind. Happy holidays, everyone. Calls for sanctioning girls wrestling continues. Osage and Charles City have the numbers. Others are growing. As the debate continues between Iowa high school wrestling programs and the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Association about sanctioning girls wrestling, North Iowa coaches continue to operate as though it will happen all in due time. Nationally, the number of males competing in the sport, while steady, has dipped at times over the last several years. The numbers have been growing, however, are girls participating in wrestling. That number has increased for the last three decades. Osage and Charles City High Schools have each seen the number of girls joining their wrestling programs grow in the last 2 years. As with any sport, the job of coaches and athletic associations alike are to keep participation and interest in sports on the rise to promote sustainability and fair competition. Enter the debate in Iowa, where one side demands proof of sustainability while the other begs for sanctioning as a catalyst for growth. In 2019, five state athletic associations in the country held votes to sanction girls' wrestling and set dates for official state championships. According to the National Federation of State High School Associations, of those states, Iowa has a larger number of girls participating than four of the five states. The IGHSAU's process of sanctioning a new sport requires that 15% of the school districts, about 50, commit to supporting a team. Union officials have stated that while schools have offered their support of sanctioning, their actual level of commitment falls short. I think we would have 50 if they would sanction it, said Osage wrestling coach Brent Jennings. I don't think there would be any problem getting 50. Suddenly, a coach's job becomes not only recruiting girls within their district to join the team, but networking with other coaches to help build their program surrounding their own. Charles City wrestling coach Rob Pittman said he and other coaches are doing their part to grow the sport. All the guys that are coaching girls, we are networking like none other, he said. For Pittman, though, it comes down to more girls doing it and more girls seeing them do it. A single female wrestler, Sienna Somberg, who wrestled on the boys' team a few years ago, helped draw interest from other girls at school, Pittman said. All of these kids kind of grew up seeing her wrestle, he said. She was our only female on the team. I think that kind of helped inspire some of them a little bit. Last year, Charles City's team consisted of seven girls, placed third in the state First Iowa Wrestling Coaches Officials Association Girls State Tournament in an unofficial competition open to all girls who competed on boys' teams during the season. The phenomenal job our wrestlers did last season. Helped get our numbers up. We've got a great young group of kids that are coming in, Pittman said. Coach Jennings has also been proactive in growing the sport, hoping to give girls the same opportunities to compete as boys. We knew we would have to have several of us do it if we were able to compete and have that opportunity for girls to wrestle. So it's nice having that network with other coaches to say, yep, we're going to do it. We'll do it too, he said. Jennings suggested that financial considerations, among others, can be a sticky point for schools as they weigh their support before an official ruling. Things like buying uniforms and travel expenses may seem trivial, but those costs can be overwhelming when you consider how far a team may have to travel in order to compete with another school if those opportunities are so few and far between. I think the challenge is, for example, I have coaching staff now to handle it, he said. It's nice and they're willing to do it. Not every school has that. For now, Jennings is working toward the goal while expressing patience. We're trying to get ahead before they sanction and have a team ready. So when they step on the mat and they do sanction it, we'll be ready to compete. I think it's going to happen. It's just a matter of how long it takes to get to that point. Mason City girls basketball starts strong, loses. Mason City girls basketball team started strong but couldn't sustain the pace in a 69-51 loss to Southeast Polk on Friday night at home. After jumping out to a 25-14 first half lead and a 39-23 halftime lead, the Mohawks were outscored 48-12 in the second half. We played our best half of the year by getting great shots and playing excellent man-to-man defense, said head coach Kurt Clausen. Unfortunately, in the second half, we did not get great shots, and they did not bring the same energy as the other team showed. As a team, the Mohawks shot just 31% from the floor, connecting on 16 of 51. From the three-point line, Mason City made just 7 of 25. Clear Lake Lions held St. Edmund to single-digit scoring in each period, including just 2 points in the third en route to their seventh consecutive victory, this one on the road. Clear Lake jumped out to a 22-6 first-period lead and never looked back, holding St. Edmund to just 11 points in the first half. The Lions have outscored their opponents 499-212 this season, beating them by an average of 41 points. The closest game this season for Clear Lake was against Mason City in a 71-64 victory on December 9. Clear Lake will host Algona January 3rd. Newman Catholic 68, Northwood Kensett 36. This contest was never in doubt as the Knights jumped out to a 21-5 first period lead and took a 45-13 lead into the locker room Friday night at home. Central Springs 29, Rockford 24. The Panthers went on the road and won for just the second time this season, but the victory was in doubt heading into the fourth period. Central Springs 2-5 was held to just 1 point in the third period and held only a 17-15 lead over Rockford, who's 3-4, heading into the final frame, where the Panthers outscored the Warriors 12-9 for the margin of victory. St. Ansgar 54, West Fork 45. St. Ansgar scored 23 first-period points and led 23-6, but had to stave off West Fork on the road. The victory was the fifth of the season for the Saints, who are now 5-1 heading into the holiday break. West Fork fell to 3-5 with the loss. Garner Hayfield, Ventura 53, Lake Mills 44. The Cardinals were in control for three periods, taking a 41-28 lead into the final frame, but had to stave off the Bulldogs, who made a late charge Friday night on the road. Osage 63, Nashua Plainfield 19, the Green Devils improved to 4-1 with an easy victory on the road Friday night. In boys basketball, Southeast Polk 58, Mason City 49, the Mohawks were in control early Friday night, taking a 38-28 lead in the locker room at halftime, but could only muster 19 points the rest of the way, including just 4 points in the third period. Newman Catholic 64, Northwood Kensett 37. The Knights improved to 4-3 with an easy victory over the night Vikings at home on Friday night. Newman Catholic jumped out to a 21-4 first quarter lead and never looked back, outscoring Northwood Kensett 44-33 the rest of the way for the margin of victory. Webster City 55, Hampton Dumont Cal 45. The Bulldogs fell to 2-4 with a home loss Friday night. Rockford 61, Central Springs 51. The Warriors improved to 5-2 with a win at home on Friday night. Rockford fell behind 17-12 in the first period, but went on a 49-34 scoring run the rest of the way for the margin of victory. West Fork 61, St. Ansgar 57. The Saints did all they could to handle the Warhawks' first loss, but came up just short on Friday night at home. In a back-and-forth affair, St. Ansgar held an 18-15 first-quarter advantage, but West Fork, 7-0, held the Saints to just 5 second-period points to take a 28-23 lead into the locker room at halftime. A final push in the fourth period fell just short for the Saints, who fell to 2-4 on the season. Lake Mills 62, Garner Hayfield Ventura 38. The Cardinals were held to just 3 first period points and fell behind 30-16 at halftime and could never recover Friday night at home. For the Cardinals, 3-4, Jeremy Subi had a team high 13 points. Charles City 67, Olwine 39. The Comets jumped out to a 22-7 first period lead and never looked back. Osage 45, Nashville Plainfield 29. And I guess that's the time we've got. That brings us to the end of the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, December 22nd. My name's Mike Dam, and I've been your reader today. This broadcast has come to you through a partnership between Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of Iris, the reader, or KCMR Radio. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for today's reading of the Des Moines Register. You are listening to Iris, your 24-hour radio reading service. Have a great day.